Li Tenghui was the president of Taiwan, and ethnic conflict was growing increasingly acrimonious. The people of Taiwan were concerned about the dangers of a cross-strait war and not about mainland Chinese culture. After the publication of my book, everybody in the trade labelled me as a China expert or an expert on mainland issues. In other words, they were not interested in me. So I decided to change my image. If I couldn't write a literary masterpiece, I could at least write popular bestsellers. Books about war in the Taiwan Strait were big sellers at the time, so I read up on the nationalist and communist militaries to see what sort of angle I could take. I decided there were too many books following this trend, and so I gave up. But I did learn something. If you want to ride a wave, you better get on early. I was beginning to panic, so I started to try my luck at just about anything. I wrote a detective novel called 13 Months, but it bombed. People were becoming instantly famous by writing about their philosophy of life, so I wrote a book on life philosophies, but it bombed too. Management studies were all the rage, so I wrote several books on secret workplace survival strategies, but they bombed too. My books on life philosophies and office management were really opportunistic works. They wouldn't sell, and I had to admit it. But 13 months should not have been confined so easily to oblivion. It was certainly an excellent piece of innovative Taiwanese detective fiction. Unfortunately, contemporary Taiwanese readers were used only to Japanese detective novels or Agatha Christie whodunits. They didn't know how to appreciate the black humour and ironic worldly sophistication of American-style hard-boiled detective novels. Perhaps I wasn't a first-rate writer, but I consoled myself with the self-mocking words of Somerset Maugham. Among second-rate writers, I was definitely first-rate. Finally, an opportunity came my way when some foreign author published a book on emotional IQ, or EQ, and it sold like hotcakes in Taiwan. I immediately pulled together all the information I'd amassed over the years about Chinese culture, from philosophies of life to business management, and quickly came out with a book entitled The Chinese EQ. Just as I expected, Chinese EQ was on the Kingston bestseller list for 6 weeks in a row, peaking at number two. To see my work displayed in the place of honour every day in bookstores made me feel great. By that time, I was a celebrated journalist, a novelist, an expert on mainland China, and a self-improvement specialist. I was also a best-selling author, and this status gave real meaning to everything else I wrote. Most people had never read my books and had no idea what I'd written. They just knew that I was a best-selling author. In the 1990s, Taiwanese society still had a certain amount of respect for best-selling authors. My luck held. After the millennium year of 2000, my books were published on the mainland one after another. I was beginning to gain a certain notoriety. Then in 2004, Chiang Shui-bian was re-elected as president. I received a retirement package from the United Daily and moved to Beijing. When I first arrived, I had a feeling of urgency and started to write very industriously. I wrote about Taiwan and Hong Kong culture for the mainland and about Beijing and Shanghai for Taiwan and Hong Kong. The most important thing I did was to bring out my comprehensive cultural guide to Beijing well before the Beijing Olympics. I was interviewed on a China Central TV books program, and thus you could say that I'd received Chinese government approval. At that point, there was only one thing that I wanted to do, write my Ulysses, or In Search of Lost Time, my literary masterpiece. In an age when there are no first-rate writers, I still wanted to prove that I was the best of all the second-rate writers. I refused all further requests to write journalism and started to concentrate solely on my novel. Since then, I've not written a single word. I have to confess that I don't have to worry about meeting my living expenses. Western philosophers say that happiness consists in being moderately famous and moderately well off, but not too famous and not too well off. I don't depend on royalties to get by. They don't amount to much anyway. The thing is, back in the early 1990s, when I was still working in Hong Kong and planning to get married, I bought a 90-square-metre apartment on Hong Kong Island in Tai Kwu Sing. After my girlfriend went to Germany and married a German, I handed the apartment over to an estate agent to rent out for me and return to Taiwan. Every year after that, when we negotiated a new rental agreement, both the rent and the value of the property had soared. When I sold it just before Hong Kong's 1997 retrocession to China, it was worth almost 10 times what I'd paid for it. In all my working life, I could never have made enough money to buy such an apartment at a later date. When the Asian financial meltdown hit, the Taiwanese dollar depreciated, but fortunately, all my money was safely in Hong Kong dollars with the HSBC. In 2004, when I moved to Beijing, I bought 3 apartments in Happiness Village No. 2, just ahead of the government prohibition on foreigners, including people from Taiwan and Hong Kong, purchasing more than one residence. I lived in one apartment and rented out the other 2. I converted all my money to Chinese renminbi, and it appreciated in value. As the world economy continued to be hit by wave after wave of crises, only China continued to flourish, and my small earnings were enough to live on quite well. I've worked very hard on my writing, but I've lost all inspiration. It disappeared exactly 2 years ago, just as official Chinese discourse announced that the global economy had entered a period of crisis while China's golden age of ascendancy had begun. From that time on, I began to see that everyone in Beijing and everywhere in China was living well. I felt so spiritually, materially satisfied, and my life was so incomparably blessed that I began to experience an overwhelming feeling of good fortune, such as I never had before. An insomniac national leader. For more than a year, except for the New Year and other holidays, I've been going to Jiang Ling's firm's restaurant on the first Sunday of every month to have dinner, drink red wine, and watch old movies. Jiang Ling is the owner of the Capital BOBO Properties Corporation. He's a member of the 3 old classes, the 3 secondary school classes of 1967, 1968, and 1969 that never graduated due to the Cultural Revolution. In 1978, when the college entrance examinations were reinstated, he went to university. He later became an official and often associated with artists and writers. Then he plunged into business in Hainan and somehow made it big in real estate. But he still has an air of culture about him and regards himself as a scholar and a merchant. He likes to discuss national affairs, and every year at Chinese New Year, he writes a few traditional-style poems and sends them off to his friends and customers. Jiang Ling is a workaholic, but 2 years ago he started a new custom. He began to have dinner with his friends and family and afterwards show an old movie on the first Sunday of every month. At first, his movie evenings were very popular, but gradually his relatives cried off, and then his friends wanted to choose the films they liked before they would show up. By the start of winter, Jiang Ling and I were often the only ones there. After the first time a friend took me along, I became a regular. I had a lot of spare time, I lived fairly nearby, and I loved to watch those post-1949 Chinese films. I hadn't got to see them in Hong Kong and Taiwan, so it was a new experience for me. I was the only one who never missed a screening. Jiang and I didn't have any connection on any other level. I didn't want anything from him, and because I wasn't especially important, he didn't have to be on his guard with me. I was the best sort of person for him to have a friendly, social relationship with. In the winter, when there were just the two of us, Jiang would bring out a bottle of red wine. Always the finest vintage, 82, 85, or 89 Bordeaux. Sometimes we'd go through 2 bottles in one evening. The Taiwanese had started drinking high-quality red wines 15 years before the mainlanders got in on the act, so I could join him in appreciating his wines, and I would willingly listen to him showing off the enological knowledge he'd picked up in books. He'd found an ideal wine-drinking partner. But whenever a crowd turned up, I noticed he was pretty parsimonious. For them, he brought out a few bottles of only ordinary vintage. This, to me, indicated our greater friendship. The only thing that concerned me was that I couldn't pay him back. That made me feel like a freeloading literary type. Zhang Li always served Bordeaux, never Burgundy. After looking up Burgundy on the net, I told him about it. He seemed curious and wanted to know more. I hit on a plan. When I went back to Taiwan for the Lunar New Year, I looked up my secondary school classmate, Ayuan. Ayuan is the largest collector of Burgundy in Taiwan. When the global economy hit the skids, Ayuan's wealth shrank, but his Burgundy collection was still intact. I'd never asked Ayuan for anything before, but this time I asked him to give me 2 bottles of good Burgundy. He gladly told me to take a few more bottles, but I declined because of customs duties. I took just 2 bottles, 1 white wine and 1 red. I sent Jiang Ling a short message asking him what was showing the following Sunday. I told him I was bringing a Petard Montrachet 1989 and a Romani Conti 1999. When I took the 2 bottles over to the restaurant, there weren't any other guests, just me and Jiang Ling. He carefully examined them, exclaiming, "Great wines, great wines! Let's open it and let it breathe." "What's on tonight?" I asked, while he gently poured the red wine into a crystal decanter. It was the 1964 film Never Forget the Class Struggle, directed by Xie Tia Li. "Have you ever seen it?" he asked. "Are you kidding? If I'd seen it, Chiang Kai-shek would have had me shot." "Those were good times, 1964, Jiang Ling said. "The 3 years natural disaster was over, people's living conditions were beginning to recover, and the Cultural Revolution had not yet started. But in 1959, old Mao was unhappy. He had nothing to do after resigning his post as national chairman, so he put out the slogan, 'Never forget the class struggle.' And this film responded to his call to remind the masses never to forget that there were still class enemies concealed among the people. It was advance notice of the coming Four Cleanups movement to cleanse politics, the economy, party organization and ideology. It was also a prelude to the Cultural Revolution. I've invited my cousin to watch the film and taste your wine," Jiang later said as we were eating. I didn't remember ever meeting his cousin, and I wasn't particularly happy about sharing my expensive wine with someone I didn't know. Just then, a rather stern and pale-faced man with sparse hair came in and greeted Zhang Ling as elder brother.
"Oh, this is my cousin, Dong Sheng. This is my good friend from Taiwan, Old Chen."
"He Dong Sheng, we've met before," I said as we shook hands. "It was at the Macau session of the Prosperous China Conference in 1992. You were the representative from Fudan University." "Yes, yes," He Dong Sheng said softly. Zhang Ling looked surprised.
"Oh, do you two know each other?"
"Yes, yes," He Dong Sheng repeated. We all felt a little awkward. "We met 20 years ago," I said. A wealthy Taiwanese named Shui Xinghua, meaning Prosperous China, had set up a foundation that held 4 Xinghua or Prosperous China conferences in the early 1990s. The idea was to invite a dozen or so promising young people from China, Taiwan and Hong Kong to get together and exchange ideas and experiences. In Macau in 1992, He Dongsheng was a mainland delegate and I was a Taiwanese delegate. He Dongsheng was just a young scholar at that time and didn't give us the impression that he was particularly outstanding. But then later, he became a high-ranking official in the Communist Party.
"This is very good wine, isn't it?"
Jiang Ling asked He Dongsheng as we drank my Burgundy. He Dongsheng nodded rather non-committally.
Old Chun brought it from Taiwan especially for me.
Ko Dongsheng raised his glass rather feebly to me, and I raised my glass slightly to him. After that, we watched the film, and nobody said a word throughout the entire thing except once when Jiang Ling commented,
"The woman playing the mother-in-law of the counter-revolutionary was really very young at the time. You can still see her quite often these days on TV."
During the screening, I took a look at He Dongsheng. He seemed to have fallen asleep. Jiang Ling was very conscientiously watching the film. He really did love those old red classics. Never Forget the Class Struggle was about an electrical machinery factory in the northeast. The workers were all striving to improve production, but then one young worker married a woman with a petty bourgeois family background. She urged her husband to buy himself a suit made of extremely expensive material, costing about 148 renminbi. The young worker's mother-in-law also urged him to hunt wild ducks during his free time and sell them at a profit on the black market. He took so much time off that his absence from work almost caused a major accident and harmed the national interest. All of this was because of a loss of revolutionary vigilance. They had forgotten about the class struggle. At the end of the film, five big blood-red words filled the screen. "Never forget the class struggle." "Pretty good," I said. "Interesting. But when young people see it now, they probably won't understand it. They'll need someone to interpret it for them." Suddenly, He Dongsheng spoke up.
"It's easy to make them work for 8 hours, but it's hard to control them after those 8 hours. Old Mao never solved that problem."
I was rather surprised that He Dongsheng would come right out and call Mao Zedong Old Mao. "Did you know, after Deng Xiaoping's reforms and openness started," he continued, "there was a magazine in Tianjin called After Work. 8 hours was work time, and after 8 hours, after work, was leisure time. But nobody knew then what to do with leisure time. Socialism had totally transformed work time, but was unable to handle after work time, the time after those 8 hours of work."
"Well, after they work 8 hours, let capitalism take care of them," Jiang Ling quipped.
"Yes, definitely," Ko Dongsheng continued. The alcohol loosened him up.
"Your old Mao cannot ask people to grasp revolution and increase production 24 hours a day. You have to let people go home and have something tasty to eat, buy some nice clothes, and indulge in some petty bourgeois fun. The people want all this, and you can't deny them it. If you don't let them enjoy themselves, who's going to work for you? Just having a good life is not too much to ask."
Most officials, when they open their mouths, seem only to come out with conventional bureaucratic patter, but what He Dongsheng was saying sounded quite normal. He began to grow on me. After expressing his opinions, he looked like a deflated balloon as he gloomily sipped his wine. We all sipped our wine together.
"This is very good wine, very good wine," Jiang Ling said again after a while. "It's better now than it was before. The flavour has completely opened out. We've been mixing white and red, and it still tastes great."
We all fell silent again. I thought He Dongsheng would leave after the film ended, but he just sat there with us. He didn't speak anymore, and he didn't touch the huge assortment of snacks that Jiang served with the wine. He just kept on slowly sipping his wine. Jiang brought out some big cigars, but we didn't want any, so he was too embarrassed to smoke alone. After the bottles and our glasses were all empty, Jiang served up some famous Wu Yi Da Hong Pao tea. He Dongsheng didn't touch it. He didn't seem to need even any water. It was just about midnight when He Dongsheng stood up and went to the toilet.
"He suffers from insomnia," Jiang Ling whispered. "He doesn't need any sleep, and I was afraid he'd stay here forever. I can't stay up all night. These days, I go to bed early and get up early."
"I go to bed early too. I hate staying up all night." I recalled that He Dongsheng had dozed off during the film.
"How about I give you a ride home?" said He Dongsheng when he got back.
"There's no need," I replied. "I live nearby. I'll walk home." Then without thinking, I asked, Is your driver still here? Of course, as a high official, his driver would always be there. I never imagined he would respond the way he did. At night, I drive myself. I like to drive. Sometimes I drive around until morning. If I'm tired, I take a nap in the car. He seemed to think that he'd said too much and muttered, "I'm going," and then left. I sort of regretted not letting He Dongsheng drive me home. I really didn't live that close. In the daytime, I would have walked it, but so late at night, I had to take a cab. It was Jiang Ling who really lived close, on the top floor of a building in the same neighborhood. "We hadn't seen each other for a long time," Jiang Ling explained, "when I saw him recently at a memorial service for my aunt, and so I thought I'd invite him over." "Your cousin's on your father's side," I said, "but your last name is Jiang and his is He. Why's that?"
"My father had two younger brothers who both joined the revolution and changed their last names. Dongshen's last name was originally Jiang."
Apparently, it was quite common for cousins in old revolutionary families to have different surnames. "What about your other uncle?" I asked.
"I don't have much contact with that side of the family," Jiang Ling answered. I was uncomfortable delving any further into Jiang's family, so I said,
"I never imagined that you and He Dongsheng were related. How high up is he now?"
"How high?" exclaimed Jiang Ling. "Right now, he's a member of the Politburo, a veteran of 3 party congresses. That's no mean achievement."
"Does that make him a national leader?" I asked.
"Strictly speaking, they should be called party and national leaders," Jiang Ling said. "On the party side, everyone from the secretaries in the party secretariat on up should be regarded as party and national leaders. That would, of course, include members of the Politburo."
Most national leaders I'd seen had well-groomed black pompadours and ruddy complexions, and they were always in high spirits. I'd never imagined I would run into a pale, balding, insomniac national leader. A titillating spring night. Standing on the pavement waiting for a cab on that early spring morning after watching an old film and drinking so much wine, I'd lost all desire for sleep. I phoned a friend of mine and went over to her place. I'd first met her over 10 years ago when she was still working at the Paradise Club, a popular Beijing nightclub and disco famous for its beautiful and cultured escorts. I am a man of modest appetites, but sometimes I have my desires, and so I looked her up. I figured it was over 2 years since I'd last seen her, and I hadn't even thought of her, not until that morning. When I returned home from my visit, I still couldn't get to sleep. I had only one question on my mind. Should I send an email to Little Xi? Big Sister Song had said that Little Xi often changed her email address, so there was no point writing one. Her address had probably already changed. And if I did write, I might be inviting trouble. She'd always been the type of woman I like. When she was running the restaurant, I was strongly attracted to her, but there were always too many customers after her. Although we'd known each other for 20 years and could be considered old friends, there'd never been anything sexual between us, not even flirting. She was always surrounded by a circle of men. Some of them were her mates, and some were suitors. There were also some unsuccessful suitors who then joined her gang of mates. She was one of those women who had only male friends and, at the same time, seemed quite unaware of the fascination she held for men. She actually believed that all her male friends were just mates. I never pursued her romantically, and she never showed any interest in me either. Later on, I thought she'd married a foreigner and moved to England. But now it looked like that had fallen through. Anyway, it'd been 7 or 8 years since I'd had any real contact with her. I'd been worried about her being a troublemaker. She wasn't one of those intellectual-style dissidents, but political trouble had been dogging her for decades, all because she was too outspoken and too stubborn. She hated injustice and thus easily offended people. In the past, many people had been willing to help her, including some foreigners. But today, foreigners like that have disappeared. None of them want to upset the Chinese Communist Party. foreigners willing to risk offending the CCP don't get a visa. Everybody around her was living the good life and couldn't be bothered with her. They were all avoiding her, and that's why she told me last time that everyone around her had changed. After talking to Big Sister Sung and Little Xi, I felt that Little Xi must be in trouble again. Now I was convinced she'd been under surveillance there in the park next to the National Art Museum. If I hooked up with her, wouldn't she bring me trouble? My life was so good now. Everything was going along smoothly and I felt extremely happy. Why should I risk it? If I saw her and she expressed the least bit of interest in me, I wouldn't be able to control myself. I found her sexually very attractive, which scared me. I hadn't felt like this about someone for a long time. If I took an emotional leap and we really got together, I could guarantee that we would not be able to get along. She still imagined me the way I'd been 10 years ago, when I'd agreed with her on everything. But I'd become one of those people she said had changed. Our present frames of mind were as different as our understandings of China's current situation. I was certain that we would never be able to agree on anything. I remembered that when Chen Shui-bian had run for re-election in Taiwan, many of my male friends supported the Nationalist Party, while their wives supported the Democratic Progressive Party, and they split up over this. I sat there in front of my computer, staring blankly at the piece of paper Big Sister Sung had given me. Suddenly it dawned on me. The one thing I had not accomplished in my life was to write a really good novel. Perhaps my life was too peaceful. I just felt too happy. I felt no pressure. Who was it that could tear me away from this excessive feeling of happiness and good fortune? Little Xi, obviously. Written on the scrap of paper was the yahoo.com email address. Fei Chen Wu Rao, okay? Next to it were the words, if you're not sincere, don't bother, okay? Chapter 2. Never Forget. Little Xi's autobiography. I am Wei Xihong. Everyone calls me Little Xi. I don't know where to start. I don't know how the world has become what it is. I'm just afraid that many things may be forgotten later. So I want to write them all down and store them in this Google file. Somebody is following me, but I haven't done anything wrong. So why are they on my tail? Maybe I'm just too nervous. Maybe there is nobody following me at all, and I'm just overly suspicious. If somebody is following me, it's bound to have something to do with Wei Guo. How did I ever give birth to such a monster? Ever since he was born, he has frightened me. He had a face like a little angel, but he lied, ingratiated himself with his teachers, ingratiated himself with anyone who would do him any good, and bullied anyone weaker than he was. His character was just naturally cruel. Okay, so he was like that from childhood. Now he writes letters informing on his classmates, getting them into trouble with the authorities and persecuting them. He is always spouting empty slogans, pretending to embrace a wonderful idealistic morality. Does he have his father's genes or my genes? Or has he inherited his character from my father? Or is he just the result of the worst possible combination of bloodlines? He blames me for not telling him who his father is, and I can understand that. He actually curses my friends using the Cultural Revolution term monsters and demons. He says they are dubious characters who could have a bad influence on his future. He laughs at me for resigning my position as a judge and says that I'm too stupid to be his mother. If that 1983 crackdown on spiritual pollution and crime had not made me understand clearly that I was not suited to be a judge, I would still be part of the public security system today. I think I am constitutionally unable to adapt to this political system. I studied law only to please my father. My father can probably be considered one of the first judges in the new China. In the 1950s, he participated in the drafting of the new constitution. I remember when I was a child and my father came home. Mother would tell us not to make any noise. We were all afraid of my father. He never once gave me a hug. My mother was probably more afraid of him than anyone else. I remember my mother never smiled if he was around. After he died, she became another person. She was reborn, and even her voice seemed louder. My mother didn't say much about the things my father did, but no doubt he must have persecuted and ruined quite a few people. My father himself was persecuted and put in prison during the Cultural Revolution. He was released only when he became ill. In 1979, after the college entrance examinations had been reinstated, I graduated from number 101 secondary school. Fully aware of my father's wishes, I listed the Peking College of Political Science and Law as my first university choice. I wanted nothing more than to become a judge after graduation. I thought that, like my father, I was a prime candidate for being a judge in our republic. My mother had told me in private that my personality was not suited to studying law. She told me to study science and engineering and keep out of trouble. At the time, I didn't agree and felt furious with her. I wanted only to make my father happy and figured that my mother was a housewife with no practical experience or understanding. People are so strange. When people treat us badly, we do what they want us to do. When people treat us well, we pay no attention to them at all. During the trial of the Gang of Four, I watched the televised proceedings with my father. Father's temper had grown even worse after the Cultural Revolution. He was very hard to get on with, and he often swore at us. He didn't achieve the success he longed for in his later years, and he took his hatred to the grave. While I was in college, people had their righteous status removed, and many who had suffered miscarriages of justice during the Cultural Revolution received political rehabilitation. Even the Gang of Four were given a trial, and state-appointed lawyers to defend them. I was full of hope for the future and utterly confident that the Communist Party intended to create a society governed by the rule of law. I graduated in 1983 and was assigned to a county-level court under the Beijing jurisdiction to serve as a legal clerk secretary. That was when my nightmare began. I was 22 years old when I arrived at my work unit in August. Everyone else there had just finished studying Party Central's 25th August document, Decision on Severely Cracking Down on Criminal Activity. They briefly explained the spirit of the document to me, and then they let me get to work. I'd always hated to see the guilty prosper and the innocent suffer, and so I was naturally very much in favor of the party and government's policy of severely and rapidly punishing criminal activity according to the law. I was certain I would not be soft on criminals. What I didn't know, however, was that the severely and rapidly that I had in mind was not the severely or rapidly that they practiced. Maybe I hadn't had enough psychological preparation, and perhaps my idea of the rule of law was too far removed from reality. In any case, the problems began as soon as I started work. The correct procedure in criminal cases was for the Public Security Bureau to arrest people, the prosecutor's office to bring charges, and the judges to decide the verdict and the sentence. In order to process cases rapidly, the Public Security Bureau, the prosecutor's office, and the legal division each assigned two people. All of us worked in an office of the Public Security Bureau. The arrest, the investigation, the decision, and the sentencing all took place practically at the same time. In those days, nobody much understood the function of a prosecutor. our judicial unit assigned two people of the lowest secretarial rank, a retired army officer who was politically reliable but who had had no legal training, and me, someone who had just graduated from law school and who was also a young woman. In this way, the chief and deputy chief of the local public security bureau basically controlled everything. I was ready to fall apart by the end of the very first day. In every case, big or small, the accused was given the death sentence, and not one of the crimes involved murder. Robbery received a death sentence, petty theft received a death sentence, swindling received a death sentence, and no one paid any attention at all when the accused produced solid exculpatory evidence. There was one case in which a young man had sexual relations with a young woman. Her family came after him. The two sides had a fight and they all received minor injuries. The girl's family went to the Public Security Bureau and had the boy arrested. The boy's family knew that this was potentially a very serious situation for him during this crackdown period. The whole family went over and knelt down in front of the girl's house to beg them to withdraw the charge, but the girl's family refused. When the case came to our six-person group, the public security chief asked us,
"What is the sentence for the crime of hooliganism?"
"This crime does not merit the death penalty," I exclaimed as soon as I could. The other five group members stared at me in silent rebuke. In the end, the boy was given an indefinite sentence of labor reform in far-off Xinjiang province. After court that day, the deputy chief of public security came over to us clutching a report and said,
"Other places are all executing 10 or more people by firing squad. Just look at Henan province. Zhengzhou, Kaifeng and Luoyang all executed 40 or 50 people at the same time. Even a place like Jiazhou executed 30 at the same time. But we haven't even reached double figures. What do you say we should do about it?"
Everybody felt under great pressure. At that point, the retired army officer who had been assigned with me said,
"The hooligan intentionally injured others. His sentence was too light and out of step with the spirit of Party Central." "Then we'll just change the sentence to execution and say he made it onto the list."
Turning to me, the deputy chief added,
"Female comrade, you should not be so kind-hearted."
His reprimand really knocked me back. That's how weak I was. That weekend, we shot 10 people in the back of the head. I was ashamed of my cowardice and felt so angry about my compromise. What good is the law? Is this a society that practices the rule of law? I debated with myself. When I returned from the execution grounds that day, I set out on a path from which there could be no return. In the next round, the court secretaries went together with the district police officers to various locations to investigate cases and arrest people. Then we took the accused to the Public Security Bureau in the county seat for trial. I had already made up my mind. For any crime that didn't deserve capital punishment, I would say so outright. Since there would be a record that one of the two judicial representatives was opposed to the death sentence, the others in the group would be unable to insist on it and would have to change the sentence. But in this way, there would be fewer death sentences, and everybody would be afraid of criticism from higher up. Members of my work unit phoned me and tried to dissuade me from acting the way I was, but I just ignored them. Later on, I came to know that even if I had not had an accident, my work unit was already planning to transfer me. One night in the county seat, an army vehicle ran into me. This was a common occurrence. In rural areas, army vehicles sped around like crazy and often ran into people. If civilians were killed or injured, they just had to accept their fate. But even though it was a common occurrence, usually if an army vehicle ran into a member of the public security authorities, there would be endless wranglings back and forth between these and the military. In my case, however, the army took me straight to number 301 hospital, and afterwards my work unit didn't inquire further into the incident. After leaving hospital, I handed in my resignation and became a person without a work unit. And my mother didn't have a bad thing to say about it. I became a privately self-employed person by opening a small restaurant with my mother. We mostly served her Guizhou-style goose. In the 1980s, Beijing was a fascinating place, the heart of an era full of promise. Our first regular customers were natives of Guizhou, especially scholars and writers who had moved to Beijing. They brought other Beijing writers, artists and scientists, and foreigners to eat and to talk. My mother loved to entertain guests, and I loved the excitement. Everybody called me Little C. We expanded our restaurant and renamed it The Five Flavors. In the autumn of 1988, I met Shi Ping and fell in love. He was a poet. There's nothing at all poetic about me, but we both cherished genuine sentiment. Shi Ping said that someday he would certainly receive the Nobel Prize for Literature, and I said I would certainly accompany him to Sweden to attend the award ceremony. That was the happiest time in my entire life. We didn't really have too much time alone together, though, because Shi Ping liked to spend time with his poet and artist mates. There were quite a few women around him, but surprisingly, I didn't mind. Every night, The Five Flavors was full of our intellectual and artistic friends, debating issues, drafting and signing manifestos, competing jealously for each other's affections, getting drunk and throwing up. The police visited us frequently, but my mother was very adept at getting rid of them. In the spring of 1989, Shi Ping and a group of his friends went to Lake Baiyangdian and stayed a few days. They'd been sent down there during the Cultural Revolution. I came back to Beijing early. I had the feeling Shi Ping was seeing one of the other women, so I found an excuse to leave. I guess I didn't want a direct confrontation. That night, the authorities closed our restaurant down. They said a group of academics had issued some sort of political statement there a few days earlier, with foreigners present. I don't know what I was thinking at the time, but I actually went to see Ban Chuntao. He was in my class at university. He grew up in this big courtyard and could be considered a member of China's red aristocracy. His whole demeanor implied that this world had been created through his force of arms, and therefore it all belonged to him. There were many people like him living in Beijing's big, old-fashioned courtyards. I'd heard that he was the highest-ranking official among my former classmates, so I went over to ask his advice. When we were in school, he often hinted that I ought to become his girlfriend. He thought that every woman should like him, but I couldn't stomach his attitude. This time, I was really stupid to think that I could take advantage of my old flame status to see if he could save my restaurant. I was in a rotten mood in the first place, and I was overconfident about the drinking capacity I thought I'd built up at the restaurant. That night, we didn't drink Chinese rice wine, but we had something called Remy Matan. I drank too fast, wasn't used to foreign liquor, and before I knew it, I was plastered. I remember Ban Chuntao pointing at the TV reporting on Mikhail Gorbachev's visit and asking me, "What do you think about Gorbachev?" When I woke up, I was in bed, and he was sitting on the sofa in his underwear reading the paper. I realized I had slept with him,
To get even with Shi Ping? I don't think I'd have done it for that. Ban Chuntao had deliberately got me drunk.
Well, this time you finally got to me, he said, when he saw I was awake.
Ban Chuntao, you've gone too far this time, I said angrily.
Well, you're no St. Joan the Virgin Martyr either, he retorted.
Ever since college, I'd always known that guys like him were smooth-talking and insincere, so I shut up. With a terrible headache, I went to the bathroom, had a quick shower, got dressed, and left without saying another word. In the days after that, everybody was busy going to Tiananmen Square. Shi Ping wrote a new poem in support of the students. I was still furious with Shi Ping, and we were both busy with our own activities on the square. Then they started shooting at us, and Shi Ping and I were separated. A couple of weeks later, I was arrested, but they let me go when they found out I was pregnant. Actually, I was already 3 months pregnant. I was so caught up in the June the 4th events that I didn't even notice. At the time, I believed it was Shi Ping's child. But later on, I didn't dare say for certain. I lived with my mother and waited for the baby. The big courtyard was full of people from political and legal circles who all knew of my situation. We had to put up with a lot of tongues wagging and fingers pointing behind our backs. Fortunately, after June 4th, everyone felt they had just survived a calamity, and they didn't want to be too nosy and attract attention. I didn't hear anything from Shi Ping for a long time. He escaped to Hong Kong in secret. Later on, he went to France and married a French woman. He never even sent me a single letter to let me know he was safe. When my son was born, I named him Wei Ming, giving him my last name. When Wei Ming was 20 years old, he changed his name to Wei Guo, exchanging the word people, Ming, for nation, Guo.
Our restaurant was closed for a year and a half, but in the following autumn, we received a notice that we could open again. Did Ban Chuntao help me? I don't think so.
Mother and I became extremely busy reopening the restaurant and trying to make a living. To begin with, business was very slow. The national economy was in decline and many people were out of work in Beijing. President Jiang Zemin had let it be known that he intended to crack down on private businesses like ours. The people who had made up our most solid customer base couldn't satisfy the thought police investigators, so their work units fired them, and they didn't have either the money or the spirit to eat in restaurants. A lot of our regulars had been foreigners, but they had not yet returned to China. Needless to say, the winter of 1991 was a cold one. In 1992, Deng Xiaoping made his southern tour in support of continued economic reforms and openness, and then Beijing's financial conditions started to improve. At that time, we worked particularly hard on our business and didn't go in for any more salon activities. My mother and I read up on some new recipes, remodeled the restaurant inside and out, trained a new cook from Guizhou, and business gradually picked up, but it was exhausting work. My mother handled the lunch crowd while I took care of my son in the daytime, then I handled the dinner crowd. Gradually, some of our old customers started drifting back. They would talk for hours, taking from 5:30 to midnight to eat dinner. Sometimes I would sit beside them and listen, but I would close up shop at midnight, no more talking until dawn. Freedom of speech at the dinner table slowly returned in the late 1990s. By listening to them talk and by reading some of the banned books from Hong Kong they gave me, I slowly began to understand what modern Chinese history had really been like, especially the things that my mother and father had been through. Our Taiwanese and Hong Kong compatriots also started coming back, along with some foreigners. Peter, or Peter, as we used to call him, arrived around the middle of 1997 when Hong Kong was returned to China. I called him Little P. He was slightly younger than me and very shy. He was a reporter stationed in Beijing, working for a foreign news agency, and he especially liked me to tell him about the Tiananmen democracy movement of 1989. After we'd known each other for a year, he very formally asked me to be his girlfriend. I thought he was decent, and nobody else seemed to be after me at the time, so I agreed. I knew that I wouldn't be with him for a lifetime. I didn't love him that much, so I refused to move in with him. Later, when he was transferred home, he asked me to marry him, but I turned him down. At that time, all my friends loved to discuss contemporary politics and criticize the government. That's why I cannot adapt to today's situation. Suddenly, in the last 2 years, since China's so-called golden age of ascendancy officially began, not only has everybody stopped criticizing the government, but they have all become extremely satisfied with the current state of affairs. I don't know how this transformation came about. My mind is a complete blank because I recently spent some time in a mental hospital, and the medicine they gave me has left me muddle-headed. My mother tells me that one day I came home and started shouting, "They're going to crack down again! They're cracking down again!" She says I didn't sleep all night and kept mumbling to myself. Early the next morning, I went out into the courtyard and started cursing the Communist Party, cursing the government, and cursing our neighbors, shouting that the law courts were all bullshit. And the courtyard was full of representatives of the Chinese legal system. Not long after that, I fainted. And when I woke up, I was in a mental hospital. My son, Wei Guo, said he had arranged it all. He said he had saved my life by preventing me from shouting all that crazy nonsense. Otherwise, if a crackdown really did start, they would probably shoot me in the head. When I was discharged, everybody around me had already changed. When I asked them what had happened while I was in hospital, they wouldn't tell me. I don't know if they were feigning ignorance or if they really didn't remember. What astonished me most was their reaction when I started to talk about the past, especially the events around 4th of June 1989. They didn't want to talk about it. Faces went blank. When we talked about the Cultural Revolution, all they could remember was the fun they had when they were sent down to the countryside. It had all turned into some sort of romantic nostalgia.